Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Midrack, where the Navy Mil Blog community's top bloggers discuss the latest developments, long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things maritime.
And welcome, everybody, to another edition of Midrats. I'm your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Today is the second part of a two-part series that we're doing on the Naval Academy, so settle down this afternoon. Enjoy the show, whether you're with us live, giving us the archive on Blog Talk Radio, or if you're one of our subscribers to the podcast on iTunes. And like I said, this is part two. Last week was part one, where we talked about the Naval Academy from the point of view of three professors. This week, we're going to turn it around and look at the end product of what the Naval Academy is supposed to be producing for us. We have three guests today, two from the about-to-be-commissioned class of 2010, Jeff Withington and Justin North. And the third will be Roger Miso. He's from the class of 2009. And I just want to make an admin note for those that saw the notice that we put out on Twitter and also on my homepage. Originally, we were going to have Donnie Horner on, who was from the class of 2008, but he had a personal scheduling conflict that came up that he wasn't able to make it. But his priorities are set up correctly. We're sorry we can't have him on. We do appreciate where he tried to make it work. So Donnie, we'll talk to you down the road. And for a reminder for those that are with us live, if you're on the show page, make sure and scroll down, join the chat room with the usual suspects. And if you have some questions or some points of order that you want to bring on, go ahead and bring them there. Eagle One's going to ride herd on the chat room, and he'll fold those in for us as the conversation goes forward. And I just... because I'm a friendly, nice, warm guy. I just want to make a note on the behalf of our still midshipmen and one ensign that while we're on today, all the views that they express are their own. They're not representing the United States Navy or the United States Naval Academy. They're representing themselves, and that's what we're going to talk about, is their experiences, what brought them to the Academy, or what they learned while they were there, and what they're going to take and bring forward as the young leaders that we have in the Navy Marine Corps. So let's get on with the show right away. Our first guest is going to be, for now, Midshipman Jeff Withington, the class of 2010. He's a future submariner from Westchester, Pennsylvania. He'll be reporting this August to Nuclear Power School in Charleston, South Carolina. At the Academy, he was an honors history major, and his focus was on the ancient world. He participated in activities from the philosophy club to intramural handball. I don't know what Admiral Rickover would have to say about that CV, but we're going to talk about that as well. Jeff, welcome to Midrats.
Hello. Nice to talk to you.
Great deal. I just want to come out of the box, and we always, you know, you sit to where you are right now, and you scratch your head and say, how did I get out? How did I wind up here? And if you could just take for a second and take yourself back to the Jeff Withington, whether you're 10 years old, 12 years old, or whether you were at the last minute going, oh, my God, where am I going to go to school? But what brought you to Annapolis in the first place?
Yeah, I guess it started really my junior year in high school. I wasn't dead set on any particular school, you know, as I looked forward to college. And one day I received this mailing from the Naval Academy promoting their summer seminar program. And summer seminar is this week-long program the Academy runs for high school seniors or rising high school seniors, where they can experience what the Naval Academy has to offer. I mean, I don't ever really remember thinking about applying to Naval Academy before this point, but something really excited me about the opportunity to attend the Academy. And I think that was that call to be part of something greater than yourself, and also that challenge to better yourself morally, mentally, and physically. So, I mean, I was accepted the summer seminar program, and I had a lot of fun. But at that point, I still wasn't 100% sure yet, because, you know, it's a big step, you know, choosing college and then, of course, choosing Academy. So by the end of that whole process, I guess I was really thinking about commissioning into the military, but I was also thinking about possibly the ROTC route. But as I toured civilian schools, I realized that none of them had that same level, I guess of what I would call community spirit that the Naval Academy had, you know, that shared bond between all the midshipmen and alumni. And that's really impressed me, just the sense of community and what our, I guess, former commandant called family at the Naval Academy really drew me there. So here I am now.
Did you have any family background in the military? We often joke that the military is a family business. Or are you kind of terra incognita?
My dad was a Navy officer. He did the OCS route and was active for 4.5 years as an aviation maintenance officer and then retired out of the reserves. So that was certainly in the house, but he didn't push me at all to go Navy or to the Naval Academy itself. So I think it probably made things easier as I thought about a career of naval service, but it was never an overt pressure, certainly.
Eagle One.
Well, congratulations. And as you entered the Naval Academy, what was your biggest surprise? What were your biggest surprises, both positively and negatively, as you attended that institution?
I was sort of surprised of how, I guess, while the challenges of plebe year were looking from the outside seemed really tremendous and terrifying. Once you're in that community and working along your fellow classmates to overcome the challenges of plebe year, it could oftentimes be, fun. It would be a word to describe it, as you sort of have to overcome the challenges put by the upper class towards you, and as you're always continually working towards goals and tests. So I guess that was one surprise. And then I guess I was also, you know, the surprises is how much you have to actually work while you're there at school, just on academics itself. And as a freshman, you have a 2,300 bedtime every night. My company was very strict in enforcing that. So I had, you know, from, let's see, last class got out around 3:20 every day. And then we had some sort of activity after school, whether that was the intramurals or if I was doing some other club activity. We had, you know, so that went to about 5 p.m. So I had really about 5 p.m., and then we had dinner at some point. And then from dinner on to 11 to get all my homework done and to get my uniforms ready for the next day. So that was, it's really surprising how much time you have to put in every day just to be ready for the next one. So
during the summers, I know that I was a ROTC guy and so was Eagle One, so we had our little exposure to the Navy. Not too much different requirement to do for the Academy, but in the last 4 years, I know things are a little different than we went through. What are the requirements that you have to do as a midshipman in the summers between your different years?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's changed somewhat since I went through. It always seems to be changing a little bit every year, but sort of the basic sketch outline is that I believe it's mandatory to do some sort of surface, a fleet cruise, whether that's with a surface ship or in a submarine. And I was really lucky. I went to Pearl Harbor for 2 out of my 3 summers at the Academy, so you can't beat the free travel there. But let's see. And then we have something called protramid, which I believe ROTC guys call quartramid. We do that in between our sophomore and junior years, where you go to do a week with the Marines, do a week with an aviation squadron, a week on a submarine. So it gives you a nice tour of the naval service. And then we had a requirement for a little bit where we had to get a leadership billet in over the summer. And I'm not sure if that's a set requirement now, so that would take the form of, like, being a plebe summer detailer, so running plebe summer or running summer seminar, which is what I did. But they give you a pretty broad range of experiences.
Eagle One.
As you've gone through school, the opportunity to meet with students from other schools and discuss the differences between the Academy and kind of measure yourself against, say you're going to history things, measure
right.
yourself against what they're doing.
Yeah, I guess a great opportunity for that was we have the Naval Academy host a Foreign Affairs Conference, which I've taken part in for the past couple of years. And this Foreign Affairs Conference draws in students and participants from colleges within the U.S. and internationally. And so we've been able to talk about issues of international politics and national security and all those kind of issues. And they've really been impressed because a lot of people don't know what the Naval Academy is and what our curriculum is coming in. And they've been really impressed to see how we've been able to talk about issues and really go toe-to-toe with people from all over. So it's been interesting.
I think, you know, one thing that when you and I talked a while ago
mm-hmm.
about your background and where you're going, it touched on something that I've blogged about intermittently that's always been something that's bothered me. And there's an institutional bias in the Navy, not just at the Academy, but in general, against non-technical majors.
Mm-hmm.
And there are good arguments on both sides. I always believe that you need to have an officer corps where you have all different backgrounds. You have some people who are nuclear engineers, some people who are philosophy majors, and I always thought that we were a little bit too hard over on the technology. As a matter of fact, we actively discriminate against non-technical majors. And one of the arguments people come back is like, well, the Navy's very technical, and if you don't have a technical background, you can't do it.
Right.
But I always went back to when I got commissioned. One of the guys who was in my ROTC class, he was a philosophy major, for God's sakes, and he went to nuclear power school, and I saw that all throughout time, is there are very successful people that do the most technical thing the Navy does, which is running a nuclear power plant, whether it's on a submarine or a surface ship. Well, if you could talk about how you, as a history major, have been prepared for, or if any prepared for being and going to nuclear power school, mm-hmm. and any type of discussions you've had to have with people along the way who kind of tilted their head at a history major
mm-hmm.
wanting to go do something that requires nuclear power training.
Yeah, I remember from my first cruise in the after my freshman year, I was headed out to Pearl Harbor and was on board one submarine whose CO was a history major from the Naval Academy. So, early on I knew it was possible to enjoy success and in a technical service with a history background. But I think the Naval Academy does a good job with its core curriculum in ensuring that even history majors have a very strong background in a technical field. So, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm still getting a bachelor's of science in history. And, let's see, what have I taken? I mean, this past semester, I've taken a nuclear version of basic thermodynamics for non-engineers and had a submarine CO, former submarine CO, teach that. And he didn't really seem to hold anything against the non-technical majors and just emphasize that you have to have a baseline, you know, of technical skills to work from. So I can't say I've really actually felt much discrimination. There is, I guess, some sort of there's some sort of feeling that a history major is somehow less hard than other majors or any that kind of talk. But I haven't really had too much problems with that from officers or instructors.
Eagle One?
As you've gone along, I know you've been one of the Naval Institute bloggers, I believe. How has that worked out for you? Were you getting some? Did you get any pressure from anybody at the Academy not to post certain things, or were they giving you a free hand?
No, I've never really heard anything from the Academy telling me to stay away from anything, or really either way. So I guess it was either under their radar, or I posted on applicable, you know, good topics. So. I've had a blast blogging for the Naval Institute, and I've got a lot of amazing opportunities. Mary Ripley being kind enough to take me on early, so it's been a lot of fun, and haven't had any issues at all with it from the Navy side.
Are you going to keep at it once you get commissioned, so everybody can wait with bated breath all the glorious, exciting things that are going to happen in nuclear power school?
Right. Yeah, I guess they want to hear about my days that start at 0645 and classes that end then at 16:15, and then I had the 5 hours of studying afterwards. Not sure what I'll fit in blogging, but you know, I'm currently looking to find some midshipman to replace me on the Naval Institute blog, and I got to talk to Mary about my future there. I really love the naval blogging community. I've had a lot of fun interacting with both other posters like Commander Salamander and Eagle One, and then just the people who comment on my posts. But I gotta think about that because, yeah, I'm not going to be doing anything tremendously exciting down there at power school that unless people want to talk about nuclear power, but that's tough.
One thing I noticed about your timeline is the fact that you're reporting to Nuke Power School in August, and it's one thing that I'm going to ask Roger about later on is the pool condition down in Pensacola with the aviation side of the house. But if you could, what does that training pipeline look for? You graduate, you'll start in August. When you come out the other end and are able to show up on a submarine?
Sure, yeah. I guess it's a little deceiving when I said I'm reporting in August because as a history major, I have to report, I guess this goes back to the earlier question, but I have to report 3 weeks earlier so I can review basic math, chemistry, and skills like that before actual reporting. So July 28th, I'll head down there to what they call preschool, and then mid-August, Nuke Power School itself starts up. So
You're going to the NAPS program for nuclear power school.
Yes. Yes. And then so I think Nuke Power School is about 6 months long. So I think it's sometime in March or February, I'm finished with Nuke Power School and then report to what's called Prototype, which is a school in Charleston or Ballston Spring, New York, where you learn how to actually operate the reactors and machinery. So while Nuke Power School itself is an academic course, this is a very hands-on, you know, overseeing an actual plant or a prototype plant. And so that lasts about, I think that's, is that another 6 months even? Yeah, I think it is another 6 months. So that brings me up to, I believe, September of 2011. And then in September 2011, I go to Submarine Officer's Basic Course, which is in Groton, Connecticut, where I learn like just basic submarine skills before reporting to a boat in November of 2011. So I will so from graduation of May 28th, I will hopefully be on a submarine by November of 2011. So it's a long, long training pipeline.
Eagle One.
If you could tell some prospective applicant to the Naval Academy why he or she should apply, what would be that one thing?
I have to go back to what really drew me, and that was the sense of community and family that the Naval Academy really has as we all struggle to overcome, you know, common challenges and all are shooting for that same goal of getting a commission in the United States Navy or Marine Corps. And that common experience and common bond really has given me some of my closest friends and given me some of my, you know, favorite memories as I look back. And, it's great academically and, you know, that's certainly one draw, but, you know, it's great academically plus has this amazing sense of community that I just don't think can be beat or found elsewhere.
And, Jeff, I think on that moment, we've kind of run out of time. That's a great way to end it. And as Eagle One said when we began, congratulations on making it through. And I hope you enjoy your commissioning ceremony and everything that comes afterwards. And we're looking forward to keeping in touch with you as you go forward in the nuclear power world.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Well, my last comment to you is that a classics major from my older son's ROTC class made it through Nuke School. So this is a challenge to history majors to see if they can be as good as a classics major.
I'll do my best.
Well, you'll be able to do calculus in Latin, if nothing else.
Right.
Take care, Jeff.
Thank you.
And just as a quick reminder to everybody, you are listening to Navy Mil Blog Radio, Midrats. I'm Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host Eagle One of the blog Eagle Speak. And we also co-blog together with our previous guest, midshipman, soon-to-be Ensign Jeff Withington over at the United States Naval Institute blog. Our second guest today is going to be an antidote to those who say that we're a little bit too Navy-centric here, because our next one is going to be midshipman Justin North, also class of 2010. He was born in Los Angeles in 84 and graduated Arcadia High in 2003. He enlisted in the Marines and entered boot camp in August of 2003, and he earned the rank of corporal in 2006, and he served as an aviation ordnanceman with the Marines. He was in the NATS class of 2006. He's coming out of the academy with a degree in political science, heading to Quantico, Virginia, after a TAD assignment, going back to NAPS to help those that are following his footsteps, with a lot of very good pedigree of people who come out of NAPS. And as all good Marines, he wants to make us proud. He wants to be an infantry officer. So, Justin, welcome to MidRaps.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you both doing today?
Doing quite well. Thank you. Hey, here's what I want to kind of come out of the pipe with here with you is, because you're prior enlisted, you came from a little different background than some of your classmates. As you enlisted, went through boot camp, everything you described there, how did you get from graduating from Arcadia High School, enlisting to the Marines, and going to boot camp, and then making a decision in your mind that the Naval Academy is where I want to go in order to move forward?
Yes, sir. It's a bit of a funny story with that. It wasn't so much my decision, and I'll kind of walk you through the process and explain how that worked out. And it ended up being the best thing that I've done in my career, and so don't get me wrong when I say that it's not my decision. But anyways, a Marine captain came to Miramar, where I was stationed, and apparently I think he worked with the admissions office or somewhere like that. Anyways, he sent out feelers to all the different departments saying, you know, we need Marines to come to this brief and, you know, populate this brief for me. My officer in charge called me into his office and said, you know, Lance Corporal at the time, Lance Corporal North, do you have any interest in being an officer? I said, all due respect, sir, not really. He said, well, that's interesting. I'm going to send you to this brief anyways. You know, go there and come back and let me know what you think. I came back. I said, sir, that was a really nice brief. The Naval Academy looks like a great place. He goes, oh, good, you want to apply? I said, oh, no, sir, not really. He says, oh, okay, and just like about going to the brief, he said, well, you're going to go ahead and fill out your packet, and you're going to apply, and we're going to see how you do. Roger that, sir. I filled out my application packet. I was just about to deploy on the Nimitz for some workups, and we realized that my packet was incomplete and that I hadn't taken my SATs. And he said, well, Lance Corporal North, you are leaving on Saturday. It is now Thursday. I've called Camp Pendleton about an hour north. You are taking the SATs there at 06:30 tomorrow morning, so that just be there and be ready. You have the rest of the day off to go to the library and prepare yourself for the SATs. And I was thinking at this point, oh, man, what have I gotten myself into? I went
beautiful.
Up to Camp Pendleton. Oops, sorry, sir, excuse me.
No, go ahead.
Anyways, I made my way up to Camp Pendleton. I took the SATs. I left on the boat, and when I came back from my workups about 6 weeks later, I finished my application packet and sent it in and found back from the academy that lo and behold, I had been accepted. And at that point, I realized that I would really be missing out on a great opportunity if I were to not attend. And so I made the choice to head over to NAPS in Newport.
Well, that sounds like a Marine Corps captain that you owe a couple of beers to. That's a great background. I think we've all been in situations like that where sometimes somebody gives us a push that we didn't know we needed. And that's a great story right there. Eagle One.
Well, despite the fact you didn't want to be an officer, now that you are going to be one, what kind of officer do you look forward to being? I mean, what models, role models do you tend to follow?
Well, so the role models that I tend to follow here at the Academy and throughout my short career have all been the types of Marines and the types of Navy officers that they care about their people. And that story was a good example of someone like that. It was just like Commander Salamander had to say, is I received a push that I didn't know I needed, but it was the chance of a lifetime. And And that's the kind of leader that I'd like to be one day, is someone that whether my Marines know it or not, I need to be there to push them in the right direction and help them make choices that are going to better themselves, both as leaders of Marines and people. And so that's the type of leader that I hope to be.
When you get your commission, I noticed in the little bio that I read to everybody, is you're going back to NAPS to help out there for a few months before you head off to Quantico. A lot of people know what NAPS is. A lot of people think they know what NAPS is, but it's always best to get it from first person. You went to NAPS. You're going there to help out at NAPS. If you could, give everybody a brief summary of why we have NAPS, what it's trying to accomplish, and what it did to you to help you succeed.
Yes, sir. NAPS, as far as I'm concerned, is an absolutely integral institution. It takes prior enlisted service members like myself, and then those who the Academy maybe doesn't have as many data points on in the admissions process, and as well as the athletes who can all do these things that the Academy values, but they may come up short in a couple areas. For me, it was certainly academics through high school, which is something that I really struggled with. And NAPS puts us all together, gives you an early sense of unit cohesion and the spirit of really working together, and then puts you through the paces for your plebe classes. It's chemistry, it's calculus, physics, and English. And they offer a lot of extra instruction and up-close and personal interaction with officers that really help you along academically. And at least for me, that there's not a chance that I could have cut the mustard academically here at the Academy without that background that I built up in NAPS. And so that's an experience that I really valued. And I look forward to heading back there and hopefully imparting some wisdom on the people that are there now.
Eagle One.
Well, let me ask a variation of a question that I asked Jeff earlier, which is if you were to give advice to someone who was in your position as a lance corporal or a corporal and some officer wanders in and says, you know, you ought to go to this session, what would you tell that individual today about why they should look into it and what benefit there is from the program?
Yes, so the advice that I would have to offer, I mean, both to junior enlisted Marines and then to anybody that's looking at the Academy is never stop challenging yourself, because that's what I've learned from those Marines that we spoke about earlier that have been influential in my life, is they've never stopped challenging themselves to make themselves better. And that's one thing that the Academy really offers, is a chance to beat yourself up every day. And sometimes, at least for me, it was beating myself over the head with books. But I kept pushing and I kept challenging myself, and it looks like I've made it through, and unless Professor Fleming, who you had on last week, doesn't see that to be fit. But anyways, just keep challenging yourself every day and work hard, and then you'll get the best results out of that, at least hopefully.
When the president spoke and he gave his Afghan speech over at West Point late last year, because of the audience that was there, I thought a lot of the networks did a really good job of panning out so you saw the cadets at West Point. And a lot of people noticed a lot of the combat infantry badge, a lot of the decorations, because a lot of the people at West Point were prior enlisted and had done a few tours in the war that we've been at for the better part of a decade here. And there's a couple of good write-ups that really focused on, unfortunately, I thought, just on West Point and what personnel who are prior enlisted who then go to the service academies, in this case West Point, what they brought that was different than their classmates who were straight out of high school when it comes to an experience of what the military really is like, but also added an extra flavor to help them understand how to become leaders, because they themselves had been enlisted and knew what a good junior officer looked like and what a junior officer who needed improvement looked like. If you could, whether for yourself or your other classmates, Navy or Marine Corps or prior enlisted, from your perspective, what does having members of your class who are prior enlisted, what does that bring to Annapolis, and what does it add to it from the point of view of helping your classmates develop into better leaders?
Yes, sir. In my opinion, what it really brings to the Academy is it's not so much what it brings to our leadership to the fleet. But what we're taking to the academy is our experiences and the ability to share those with our classmates and with the underclass and explain to them, just like you said, you know, what a good junior officer looks like and what one that needs looks like, and then how to give that correction and how to interact with enlisted personnel. I mean, I talk with my friends frequently about, you know, this is what I would have thought as a corporal, and I look to be careful to avoid some of those pitfalls or to mimic that really impressive behavior in the eyes of those corporals and lance corporals. And so when we talk about that stuff, we sort of try to come up with a plan where it would really impress those corporals and lance corporals and how to make them, I guess, how to best lead them from coming from where we are right now.
Eagle One.
Well, let me go with a variation of that. How was it for you with some military experience going through the academy? Did you find some things that are traditionally done to incoming plebes just sort of humorous, or how did that impact your prior experience impact your experience at Naval Academy?
Yes, sir. I think it added some things and took some things away from me. As far as things that it added, it gave me a sense of maybe why they might be doing certain things and why they were making it hard on us when they were, whereas some of my classmates may not have been so sure why these things were happening. I guess I had a broader view of things. And as far as some things that it made difficult, I mean, when I was a plebe, I was older than my company commander and my training officer and my training sergeant and pretty much my entire midshipman chain of command. And so every now and again, when they would say something like, "Well, you know, in my experience, this is what I think," and that always kind of made me raise my eyebrow or maybe roll my eyes a little bit, which might have got me in more trouble than I wanted it to, but. It taught me a good lesson, which is that a young leader should probably be careful about saying, "in my experience," and then following with something, because their experience is invariably pretty limited.
Yeah, just a word of advice. An old leader needs to be careful of that, too.
Especially when it comes to giving IT advice, in my experience. Another thing is, when I was on active duty, one of the things that I'm still very happy about it. I had an opportunity on more than one occasion to work with General Mattis in various times over the last decade. And I know he's an intellectual driver in the Marine Corps. And one of the things that he emphasizes a lot and can get animated about is reading books in history. And I got a little grin when you said more than once, you know, you're getting beat over the head with books. But I also know that every Marine I know really wants to understand, wants to learn, wants to see what happened beforehand to help make things better for themselves and the Marines they're leading later. Even though you're not a big book guy, or maybe you've become one, I don't know. But as a soon-to-be second lieutenant in the Marine Corps, if you were going to look at three books that you've looked at that are really good for where you are at this place, at this time, or somewhere out there in some ROTC unit, there was a college sophomore who was looking to go in Marine Corps option. What three books really kind of grabbed you to think of?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Although when I talk about books beating me about the head, I'm talking more around the technical subjects that you were talking about, Jeff, with. As far as reading, I've been an avid reader since I was young, and so that's kind of right up my alley. Anyways, I'm reading right now The Winds of War by Herman Wouk, and that's more from the naval side of things, but it's a really great history and dramatization to an extent of World War II. I've really been enjoying that, and they're getting into the history of why that war started and things like that. I've been enjoying more from a warfighter's point of view. I think Stephen Pressfield's work has been really excellent. I really enjoyed Killing Rommel, and I also just finished the Afghan campaign. The Afghan campaign was terrific, just reading about the parallels between what we're doing there now and what was done there, you know, centuries ago and the parallels, really, because it's very similar. And then with Killing Rommel, the thing that I really took away from that is, you know, oftentimes the Nazis were painted as absolute maniac criminals. And although many of them were, Rommel was the epitome of an officer and a gentleman, although he was not on, obviously, the right side of that war. He always took care to show respect to enemy combatants And he really carried himself well as an officer, and I thought that was something interesting to come away with that I didn't anticipate.
Just as a sidebar to that, I think you'll enjoy this, as I had an opportunity to work with a German Army one-star and in his office. In the back, if you walked into his office, you didn't see it. You had to turn around to see it. You see it when you're walking out. He had about an 8.5 by 11 black and white photograph of Field Marshal Rommel in there. And it kind of took me back until I talked to a couple of my German colleagues. And he is one of the few leaders from World War II that still is respectable enough that a 21st century German general officer can have his picture in his office, and it's perfectly acceptable. So I think that is, I share the same opinion you have with Rommel. And Eagle One, over to you.
Yeah, I think that's a really important, you've mentioned some really good books. I think the Winds of War series is terrific. And I think your recognition that Rommel could be both on the wrong side and a good guy is important. One of the things that General Mattis and others at a recent conference I was at were discussing was the ability to get into not only the shoes of your allies and understand where they're coming from, which I think with your political science background that might be good, but also being able to get into the mindset of your enemy and figure out where he stands. I know that when we interviewed Jim Zumwalt the other, he was surprised to find out how much he had in common with the Vietnamese enemies that we'd fought for so long. Do you see that as a valuable? Here you're dealing with two, enemies: the Navy and the Winds of War, and the former Germans in the Rommel book. But do you see that as an asset to you?
Yes, sir. The thing that's really impressed me about General Mattis and every senior Marine officer that's spoken to us and to me about things that are important to realize is that the aspect of war that doesn't change is it's fought people against people, and the military in itself is in the business of people. And so the more that you can understand about not just your enemies and yourselves, but any humankind and mankind just as a whole, I think the better off that you are both to lead your own men and to lead those men against the enemy.
Justin, a question for you here. We tend to be a very Navy-centric show, and I'm guilty of that as anybody else. But there is a distinct difference when you look at the, not so much a mindset, but a view of doing business of an average group of naval officers and an average group of Marine Corps officers. And a Marine Corps colonel I worked with for a few months, he always used to joke about the Marine Corps is a cult. We know it's a cult. We're very happy that it's a cult. And don't tell me it's not one. I wasn't going to argue with it because that's pretty accurate. But there is kind of a mindset for a Marine. And if there was a young man or woman out there who was looking, they wanted to serve their country, and they're trying to find what service has the right mindset or the right challenge or the right drive that they want to go invest their time and effort in, what makes a Marine different in how they work together and how they accomplish their mission, perhaps compared to other services, with all your biases to the side, of course.
I will do my best not to step on anybody's toes, but I would say that in my opinion, the biggest difference is initiative. The Marine Corps really preaches to its young officers that you set your Marines up by telling them what your commander's intent is, what you expect. And you don't tell them how to do it. You tell them the end result, and you're just surprised by how they do it. Because that's the thing is, your junior Marines are capable of doing it. They're tremendous leaders in their own right. And I think that sometimes the other services may get it wrong in so much as they assume that they know how to do it as a junior officer, and they can tell their men and women how to do it, when really all they need to do is say what needs done and let their young enlisted impress them. And I think that's something that the Marine Corps does tremendously well.
Eagle One, we'll let you have the final question for Justin. Or maybe we aren't. Eagle One, you there?
I guess Well, here I am. You know, it's the button, the on-off switch got me again. I just want to wish him the best of luck in the future, and all the best. I think his answer to your last question was terrific. So good luck out there, and Godspeed.
Thank you very much, sir. It's really been a pleasure to spend the afternoon with you gentlemen.
Justin, thank you very much, and congratulations to you two as well. And keep in touch down the road if you want to. We'd like to keep track of you.
Yes, sir, I certainly will, just to, if nothing else, but to keep the Marine Corps, you know, hard and heavy in your blog.
Always. Okay, everybody, we have one more guest today. Our third guest is going to be from the class of 2009, Ensign Roger Miso. He graduated upstate correction. He's actually from upstate New York, from the small town of Red Creek. He came to Naval Academy. I day was 3 days after his high school graduation, which makes you respect him because you don't want to know what I did after I graduated from high school for a few weeks. He's a political science major, again, from the non-technical side of the house. He participated with the Naval Academy's Foreign Affairs Conference all 4 years, and he served as a midshipman director in 2009. During 2008, good thing for a political science major to do, he founded and led Operation Vote to get, via absentee ballot or otherwise, to get out the vote drive in Naval Academy history, the largest one. He helped register over 2,500 midshipmen to vote in both the primaries and the general election. He shook the president's hand on 22 May 2009, and with his Bachelor's of Science in Political Science and a commission, he headed down to Pensacola to try to learn how to be an aviator. And he went there in June of 2009. And right now he's at the intermediate phase down at VT-10, which tells me he's going to be a naval flight officer. Ensign Miso, Roger to you and me. Welcome to Midroutes.
It's great to be here, and congratulations, too, to Jeff and Justin on their impending commissioning. That's great news for them, and always a great thing. But I'm glad to be here.
So let me get this right. You've been in Pensacola for 11 months so far, right?
That's correct. Yes, sir.
So how is Pensacola, and do you have any good Flo-Bama stories for us before we get into the meat of the conversation?
Well, it's raining here right now, so there's no flying today, but there's always a good Flo-Bama story. I just don't know if any are good for the air, you know. So we'll I'm sure your viewership will appreciate that we keep those private. So
Naval aviation is naval aviation. We're all wonderful professionals, and I'm sure the knitting club should be very busy in your off time. But, hey, let's get serious for a minute. You're from upstate New York, and upstate New York is not one of these places like Norfolk, Virginia, or San Diego where you're soaked in the Navy culture. Every other person is either in the Navy, retired from the Navy, works from the Navy. So what was it that a guy from upstate New York developed an interest in the Navy to begin with, and then made a decision that, hey, not only interested in the Navy and serving my country that way, but when I go to college, I want to go to the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland.
Well, I'll tell you. I had good parents, and I think one of the best things they did from an early age was to encourage me to read, you know, and encourage me that, you know, you can do whatever you want to do. You can be whatever you want to be. And I have a military background, I guess you could say. My grandfather was in pre-Vietnam. He was in Cambodia with the Marines. He was enlisted. My dad is still in the Army National Guard. So I didn't live like an on-base life. I mean, he did the National Guard thing. So, you know, a few weekends a month. You know, I kind of always heard, you know, from Grandpa and Dad, you know, that, oh, wow, West Point's, you know, West Point's just a few hours away. That's a good school. And, you know, I always said my whole life that, I'm not gonna be like you. You know, I'm not gonna join the military. No way. You know, but I think that it was the summer before my senior year. I think that transformation. I think that that Jeff talked about earlier. You know, where you kind of realize that. Well, yeah, you can be whatever you want to be. You know, Mom and Dad are right. And do you want to do something that's easy?
and simple and repetitive and monotonous, or do you want to do something challenging and something exciting and something world-changing? And for me, that was a draw at the Naval Academy, and it was a pretty strong draw, like you say, for a kid from upstate New York who applied to the Naval Academy, got in, and the first time I showed up, I was at the Naval Academy, was about a month before I-Day. I came down for the Memorial Day holiday, so it was a nice, oh, okay, well, that's where that is. All right, see you in a month. So it was a pretty strong draw, and I think, you know, like I mentioned, having a good foundation of, you know, what we do in our family is, you know, serve our country. So, that's my story. That's kind of where I come from.
That works for me. That sounds very familiar. And I don't come from a military family either. I mean, obviously there's a little bit of an age difference between the two of us because both of my grandfathers were battleship sailors in World War I, but that was about it. And I think just sometimes you can get a hook in you, and just a little bit of pressure, it can pull you back in. Like, it pulled you a little harder because you went to Annapolis, and I was a ROTC guy, so I'll give you a gold star for that one. Eagle One.
Well, as you have spent time away from the Academy, how do you look back on the experience? What things do you remember fondly and not so fondly?
You know, it's still setting in that I actually graduated. It was a long and short 4 years at the same time, if that makes any sense. But I miss most and look back fondly upon the people. Obviously, you know, the friendships that I had there, both with midshipmen and with you know, instructors and professors and coaches and things like that. Definitely draws together, you know, some of the best personalities, I think, in the world, you know, to go and to learn. Some of the things I don't miss, what don't I miss? That's a good question. There are so many things that I don't miss that it's hard to really put a finger on one, but, you know, I think anyways, in the aviation side of the house, I think we had our first uniform inspection. I think I've had two since I've been down here. So don't miss those every morning over in Stribling, you know, T-Court. But other than that, yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, I think one of the good things about the Naval Academy, and I think one of the reasons why it's essential in conjunction with commissioning sources like ROTC and OCS is, by the time we get out, we are used to being in the Navy. So for me, leaving Annapolis and transitioning to, you know, living a commissioned officer's life wasn't difficult because I'd worn the uniform every day. You know, I'd interacted with officers every day. I'd accomplished some sort of a mission, you know, every day. So that's a fond thing. That's a good thing, too, I think, about Annapolis is that you kind of get out and, you know, there are differences, obviously, but you kind of know the ropes a little bit, so to speak.
You mentioned, this is Sal again, you mentioned something in answer to your first question that got my attention. You mentioned that one of the things that brought you to Annapolis is you were drawn to a challenge and you wanted to be involved with something that was world-changing. And obviously the world-changing thing, when you get your wings and you move out to your first deployment and following tours, you'll get the opportunity to get your wedge in there. But the challenge of the Naval Academy, did you really feel that you were challenged in either the degree you wanted to be challenged or the way that you wanted to be challenged? And when you look at it from a one-year's perspective, when it comes to challenging young men and women, is there something that they did there that you think they should do more of?
That's a great question. Everybody comes into the Naval Academy with their own story, with their own set of, you know, of circumstances. I came in, and probably the biggest challenge for me is that I didn't know how to swim when I went to the Academy. And my friends from New York will tell you in trying to, you know, they kind of got together a few months before and were like, yeah, we don't really know how you're going to do this, but good luck. That was a challenge. And I had to basically, you know, be somewhat on my own there and figure out, okay, how am I going to get from right here where I can't, you know, float in the water to passing plebe swimming, youngster swimming, 40-year swim, second-class year. And that kind of forged, you know, a work ethic and a character and kind of employing my resources to do that in addition to all that. So I don't think there's anything that the Naval Academy really needs to change. I think they have a good structure set up. They have a good athletic, academic, professional development structure set up. And enough people come in with different stories and different circumstances that you have kids like me who don't know how to swim. You have kids who have a tough time with chemistry. Oh, my goodness. There's another unfond memory. Chalk that one up. Chemistry. kids who have a tough time, you know, passing the PRT or whatnot. But the good thing about the Naval Academy is that there is, you know, ample amount of resources for you to go in. And if you're struggling, to get help and to get through. Because really what we want aren't people. We don't want all stars. Yeah, that's great. Everybody wants a Michael Jordan. You know, they want a LeBron James and whatnot. But what we want are people who aren't afraid to go to your first-class midshipmen, your instructors, and say, hey, I don't understand this. I need help. Because that shows that you want to get things done, you know. And that translates directly over here into the fleet where you, you know, go to the chief and ask the chief, hey, what is this? How do I do this? How do we do this together? Or for me, go to the in-flight instructor and say, we're at 10,000 feet and I'm completely lost. I need some help. So that's my little anecdote there.
Eagle One.
I have a couple of questions that I'm going to tie together, I think. One of them is you were on a foreign affairs or you ran a foreign affairs program at the academy, and I'd like you to discuss that and where you see that. Does that play a part in your future? And the second one is a question that Mary Ripley has posed about the honor code, and are those two things tied together somewhere? There's a simple question for you.
Is the foreign affairs conference and the honor code tied together? Is that the kind of the question?
Well, I'd like to know more about the Foreign Affairs Conference, and then is there an honor code link there somewhere with that?
Sure. I'll talk about the Foreign Affairs Conference for a little bit. 49th year was this year. Next year will be the 50th anniversary. It's a great opportunity for midshipmen, like we mentioned. It's the largest in the country, so we have a couple hundred students come out from around the world. I think last year when I was in charge, we had something like 18 or 20 different countries come out. So we're talking both foreign universities, so civilian students, and foreign military students. I think it was the first time that we'd worked with a couple of African countries came out, various European countries, Japan, and other nations. And then also domestic, our military academies always come, always send a few students, and then domestic civilian students. So everything from Harvard to Hampton to, you know, USC and Pepperdine come out. So we get a pretty good spread. And, you know, it's themed every year. So my plebe year, the theme was a continent theme, so it was Africa. The year after that was Asia. Last year we went away from a continent or regional topic, and we talked about global poverty, and we kind of split it up into various roundtable discussions and had some very important people come out and talk about what they, you know, their experiences. Last year we had Dr. Paul Farmer come out from Doctors Without Borders, incredible guy. I mean, we've heard from Henry Kissinger and Donald Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, so we kind of run the whole gamut. But what's important about it, at least from a midshipman standpoint, isn't just the you know, academic side of learning what there is to know about the world. But, you know, my staff and I, who ran the show, basically, it's a midshipman run conference, is that, you know, it is, you're basically handed the reins of a business, an organization, essentially, and you're told, okay, go make it run. And with very little, you know, outside, you know, calling the shots, you basically are running it. And it's it comes together wonderfully every year. We've got a couple of great academic advisors last year in Lieutenant Glenn Schatz and Professor Rebecca Chavez, who just did a phenomenal job. So it's exciting. It's exciting to kind of strut our stuff as an academy. And I think everyone, all the civilians and foreign military, come away with it with kind of in awe of what we're able to do. As far as the honor code, there is definitely a link there, I think, in that, you know, we get to kind of show how we operate the Naval Academy to outsiders, and they kind of see that, you know, their tax dollars are being put to good use. So we definitely keep a tight ship, and just like the rest of the brigade, you know, we have a mission, we accomplish the mission, and we expect everyone to behave honorably, and they do.
If you, as you look toward the future, does that foreign affairs conference loom something you'd like to do as a, like a foreign, whatever the foreign specialty officer, whatever the term is, foreign, whatever the, I forgot the term anyway. And in that sense, do the foreign affairs and the honor code kind of deal with shades of gray sometimes?
You know, I think that they do a lot of the times, you know, I guess it depends on your view of the subject, but, you know, honor isn't always really black and white, and especially, you know, in the Naval Academy, outside of the Naval Academy, you know, the right thing to do, it isn't always black and white. And the same thing with foreign affairs, you know, the same thing, you know, things we talk about as far as, you know, delivering foreign aid to a nation versus, you know, maybe not delivering foreign aid, but in the form of monetary investment, but in the form of troops or in the form of diplomatic workers through the State Department or just not being involved nationally at all. So it definitely, there's definitely a lot of gray there. And that's kind of one of the takeaways from the conference is that it's a good thing, I think, it's a great thing that the conference exists because it allows students and young people to think seriously about these problems and develop actionable solutions to these problems in conjunction with some of the heavy hitters of the world, the Kissingers, the Rices, the Dr. Farmers, who talk and also listen to, you know, what we have to say.
I think that's a great program that y'all have going there, and I think you touched on it briefly. And what you have there is you have future leaders in the military getting together with future leaders and decision makers on the civilian side of the house, and that can help break down some of that civilian-military divide, which is usually just based upon ignorance of not really understanding what the other side of the equation is like, what their personalities are like. And when you can personalize that on a one-on-one basis, I think you're going to find a lot of these people that you met from Princeton and Harvard and such, you're going to be seeing them over the next 10 or 15 years down the road. And we just have a little more than a minute left, Roger, so I want to come to something that's really near and dear to your heart. What airplane do you want to wind up in and why?
I want to end up in the Prowler. Besides the fact that it is the sexiest airplane in the fleet, electronic warfare, I think, as a naval flight officer, the guy in the backseat, is probably the most important job in aviation other than flying the airplane to make sure it doesn't crash. So it's sexy and it's applicable to the flight that we're doing right now. So.
I think that's fair. And we'll let you get back to Pensacola and wait for the rain to go by. And I know you live by the flight schedule, but I just wanted to thank you, Roger, and also Justin and Jeff for taking time this afternoon to come on Midrats and to let the listeners hear about the future.
All right. Thanks a lot for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for your service, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Good show. And I just wanted to let everybody know, please join us next week for Midrats. We're going to have a real special show We're going to focus on Navy Air during the Korean War. And as our guest, our first guest, is going to be Medal of Honor awardee Captain Tom Hudner, Jr. And also we are going to have as our second guest the author David Sears of the book Such Men as These, The Story of Navy Pilots Who Flew in the Deadly Skies Over Korea. Thanks again, everybody. Please join us next time. I hope you have a great Navy Day.
Hoping you're the same.